What exactly is an island of misfits? Often a community that's misunderstood, known far away from the outside world, and usually kept a secret by society so we can't find them. Well, it seems like an ideal place to make animated characters of all walks of life. And in this community, in Halifax, Nova Scotia, Philip Stamp does just that. He creates incredible characters and brings them to life. Stay tuned.
Welcome to Passion to Power with your host, Michelle Zeitlin. She's a creative producer who quote-unquote wears many hats. She's also a talent and literary manager and founded the company Morzat Productions and Management. She develops people and projects across all media. Her guests encompass the gamut, from artists to authors, actors to activists. Please welcome Michelle Zeitlin, Passion to Power.
I want to jump into your fabulous story. I was excited because you've had such a wonderful broad spectrum that you've traveled in terms of being on both sides of the proverbial pitch deck, also being on all sides of production, right? Can you kind of give us a background? Because our listeners are in two pods, I think I explained. We have an 18 to 26er group, diehard aspiring creatives that want to know, what are those kernels of gold? What's your unique story? Because everyone thinks, oh, there's a special trajectory. You get on this treadmill here and you follow it and you get to destination. And I found that's rarely the case. People have a unique travel trajectory. And then the other group are the shifters. And during the last couple, well, now we're going on to almost 3 years of a worldwide pandemic in and out, people in the 42 to 59 analytic who are exploring all kinds of options. Are they going to go into the office? Are they going to work for themselves? Should I stay as a CEO? Should I be an entrepreneur? So I would love for you to speak to that group, which is my pod as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I can certainly speak to both. I mean, my own story, not that I really want to talk about that too much, but I mean, it was really very meandering. And a lot of it was down to one simple fact, which is that I'm very curious. I would be, you know, I didn't start off, my education didn't initially start off in this industry. I jumped to it after a certain point. And I started off because I love to draw. That was what got me really into this industry, is a love for drawing. Now, you don't have to have that, but I would say that certainly a love for working with creative people, for being around creative people, for sharing ideas and watching the ideas grow was the creative side of me that really went down that route. If you are the type of artist that you have something to say and it's your thing and you're guarded and passionate about your specific thing, it's not going to happen if you don't collaborate. Or I wouldn't say it's not going to happen. You should always try and do whatever you're passionate about, but it's a lot harder to do these things or to get these ideas out on your own. And what I also discovered was that other people's ideas were often really fun to work on as well. So somebody else would bring something, and if I could bring something to it and help grow it and build it, it was great. So, I mean, starting off as an animator, initially, you're very collaborative. In fact, one of the things that animators are taught is how to draw to emulate other people's styles. So you have to really work to sort of lose your own, you know, get rid of your own ego in the situation to throw your, you know, your talent and skill and creativity behind somebody else's idea. I really enjoyed doing that. But a part of it was also that I liked seeing how the puzzles came together. And when I was starting my career, it was in the early 90s, and that was at a stage when animation technology, both in the sort of traditional 2D, you know, pencil and paper world, was actually also really changing in leaps and bounds. I remember the first animation studio I worked in had an entire room of people with paints and acetate cells, and were painting cells by hand. And within a year of me being there, that was all changed to, you know, the digital ink and paint systems. And of course, 3D animation technology was really on an upswing at that point. It was becoming a little bit more reasonable on a television scale and on an operation scale. It wasn't just all the, you know, big players that could access those expensive $250,000 CGI or SGI boxes at the time. And I liked seeing how the puzzles came together. So I kind of did a little bit of a lot of different things simply because I was really curious. And that expression, you know, jack of all trades and master of none, was always in the back of my mind. But, you know, I had heard at one point that the second part of that expression is jack of all trades and master of none, but still better by far than a master of none. So that notion of being able to be good at a number of things, or at least competent at a number of things, led me to, as you said, being on sort of both sides of the pitch deck, because I did have ideas that I wanted to get made. I did have shows. I did have things that I wanted to get out there. And I thought, you know what, if I know how the machine works, if I understand how to get something made, then my chances of getting something made are better than just getting the idea out there, particularly knowing that you have to collaborate on the idea anyway. You need a lot of people in order to get it going. So I, you know, yeah, gosh, did, you know, a bunch of different things, went from being a designer to a storyboard artist, to a script writer, to an editor, to a video editor, to a series director, from series director into jumping back and forth from TV animation to visual effects, and was very fortunate. I got to work with some incredibly talented people over the years and was always, again, asking questions. How do you do that? How do you achieve that small thing? How do you achieve that line? How do you get that to look like it has weight? How do you get that curve in there? And on all that to how is it that you use light and, you know, volumetric light in a scene, and what textures are you using to get the specular hit just so, or what process is that? Is it in camera? Is it post? Is it this? Is it that? And trying to understand those things sort of so that when I wanted to make pictures or produce pictures with other people, that I would have an understanding of how to get it done. One of the things that I always say is that, and this goes back to when I was at, you know, in school studying animation, and we were given a task basically teaching us how to draw a location. If you're going to do a location design, and this held true whether it was, you know, a live action, an architectural view of something, or a design for animation or theater or whatever it was, you wanted an orthographic two-point perspective. For those of the listeners that know that, an orthographic two-point perspective view, which when you draw that out, it actually does look like a box. And, you know, we were taught, you know, draw using this perspective, create a location. And then my class, almost everybody did a room, you know, with the four sides of this orthographic view of this box. Most people did a room. And there was a guy in my class, I remember, who had been previous to that working with Marvel Comics and had been drawing Spider-Man for a living. And so was used to looking at down shots of Manhattan and see it. So whereas other people were drawing a single room, this guy wound up drawing Manhattan in the same space.
Wow.
So since then, I've said, you know what, clearly limits are no limit to a really creative mind, right? So what you should do is not think that those limits are a limit to you creatively. They're simply a limit to the tools that you have to use, or the resources you have at your disposal. They're not a limit to your creativity. As a matter of fact, if anything, they promote your creativity. So sometimes, you know, when I get involved in a project, in fact, every time I get involved in a project, the first thing I try and do is see what the box is, see where those boundaries are. And sometimes the box is you only have a certain amount of money to work with. So you can't just be willy-nilly try and, you know, trial and error. And there are some productions that I've worked on, you know, that were guided by, you know, a directorial or a producer hand, where there was a large coffer in the background and trial and error was completely okay. You would, you know, again and again and again and again and again to see what would work. But when you don't have as many resources at your disposal, it's really important to know the tools that you're using, and more importantly, to know the tools you're not using, so that creative decisions that you're making are staying within the confines of the box that you have put before you. And if that box is, you know, you've got, say you have a development budget of $250,000, the last thing you want to do is plan out, you know, $300,000 worth of work when you've only got $250,000 worth of resources to make it happen. So again, really, really important to know all of those things. And it's the thing that I would say to anybody, and it doesn't matter. There's so many people out there who are like, oh, I can't draw, I'm not creative. Drawing has nothing to do with being creative. Creative is all about putting ideas together. And the thing that I would say to anybody out there in the audience, no matter what position that they're in, whether they've been doing something and they're making a shift, or, you know, this is a thing that they've been at for a long time. Get to know the tools, get to know the things that are involved. You don't have to become an expert at them. You simply need to know that they're there and why they're there. And once you get to know those things, then it becomes way easier to, you know, to get what's in your head out there, because you're going to have to collaborate anyway. You're going to need, whether you're the most brilliant artist, whether you're an amazing painter, whether you're an amazing writer, it doesn't matter. You're still going to need other people. And if you are the one that actually knows the boundaries, and if you know them better than anybody else, then the great creativity is how to use the things that you have in the box, how to use those things and put those things together to get something amazing to come out of that.
Started talking about the actual box as really a box, you know, a design element. And then you ended up talking about the box as sort of a metaphor, your paradigm. And I really love that analogy.
No, absolutely. It's dictated a number of things that I've done over the years. It was a real eye opener, you know, and also such an obvious thing, right? Like, restrictions are really not any restriction to creativity whatsoever. You know, I've said many times that, you know, you look at some of the, not to be too wanky, but I mean, like Pablo Picasso's studies on horses, charcoal on paper, are breathtaking, as are his bigger works, you know, like, so a real artist can do something beautiful with very little, as well as, you know, with a lot. I would actually say it's much harder to get good results the more resources you've got at your disposal, because it's a lot more to conduct, it's a lot more to manage.
I think a lot of being creative is being creatively inspired by the people you collaborate with. And certainly if you go on the IOM website, I mean, just the names of all the jobs, I don't even know what they all mean. I do know what a storyboard artist is, but then you have the layout artists and the, you know, they have the finishers, and there's so many names. You see this on the great big Pixar movie credits, right? There's just hundreds and hundreds of people and across the world who are hired for these particular jobs.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, you know, they're all really important. There's, you know, they're all incredibly important. It's something I've tried to sort of communicate with the crew as much as possible, where I said, it doesn't matter if you're the series director, or, you know, you're the fresh out of school, like your first job, and you're, you know, designing props or assisting, you know, animation in some way. The fact of the matter is that if the job is there, it's because somebody needs to do it. It's necessary. It's important to get the bigger picture done. So don't think that your part in that bigger picture is any less important than anything else. If it wasn't important, it wouldn't be there. So I completely agree with what you're saying in that, you know, in terms of it being inspired by the people that you're with. And I regularly take inspiration from a number of different people on the crew. And it can be anybody. It could be anybody from, you know, your IT director to your, you know, your people in your accounting department, to anybody really. So it's also the kind of the nice thing about any type of art is anybody that consumes it has a valid opinion. You might think that having a lot of money behind an organization means it's going to be very well run, and that is not necessarily the case. And so I've had other experiences on other teams, big teams, small teams, where it was more personally and professionally satisfying, I would say. And again, like, you know, one of those sort of things where you sort of go, well, what's, you know, what's the most amazing place I could work at? What would be the most incredible thing? And certainly, you know, 10-year-old me would have thought, gosh, getting to go and work at a company like Lucasfilm on a Star Wars project would be the be-all, end-all. And it wasn't. There were other things prior to and other things since then that have been more gratifying.
I always say I'm in my 12th life, and the whole idea of podcasting basically came out of a very slow period in our industry where everything sort of stopped. Worldwide pandemic. I had started the idea of the podcast because I had sold one to NBC for a couple of my true crime clients. But the idea is, everybody used to say to me, well, you're so good at teaching. You're such a mentor. Why don't you make an extension of your Passion to Power educational forum? And I thought, okay. So I did a couple in front of a live audience, and then it all pivoted to Zoom when the world just changed. But what came out of that was also this incredible honesty, incredible nakedness of people. Everybody became incredibly purpose-driven. And if they weren't already, became more so, more invested in why am I doing this every single day? And I think the idea of doing good work and satisfying work, there's a resurgence of kindness, resurgence of wanting to help, and a resurgence on the personal front of wanting to be in a place where you feel like you're contributing in your work. As Jocelyn said, your influence matters, you know, that what you do matters. What do you think about that? And what do you think recently, and let's say in the last 5 years, was some of your greatest contribution and your most enjoyable?
Yeah, that's an interesting sort of thought process to go down. I mean, I would say amongst the more interesting and gratifying experiences have been certainly Island of Misfits from the inception of that. I've been very lucky. I have a couple of partners that I was with that started that off, and people who we talked about what we wanted to do, and we talked about the types of things that we believed in and how we thought we should get there. And so we said, okay, let's throw down behind a couple of things. So one of the things that was very gratifying that we did was take some of our resources towards making content with no audience. Like, we had no distributor, we had no buyer, it was just like, we just want to make something for us. We just want to make something that we find fun, something that we think is cute or interesting, and not worrying about many of the things that you often get caught up in. Not going to worry about doing all of the technological QC that you need to do on a, you know, massive delivery to somebody like Netflix or Amazon or Hulu or whatever. Not worrying about these things, just looking at a pictures in motion with music and sound and going, I like that. I like that. I think that's really fun. And doing that with other people who are getting the same thing out of it as you, people on the team and people throwing in ideas. And so, you know, we made a bunch of shorts, like animated shorts for different things. We did one with a group of characters that we called the Little Stompers, which are these adorable little dinosaurs. And we did another one with another couple of, well, dinosaurs were a bit of a theme. So it's a little bit unoriginal on that side, but we tried to do some original things with them. So we did another little dinosaur thing that we called Toof and Doof, which was a real homage to classic animation, like old Coyote Roadrunner or that kind of thing, slapstick, Tom and Jerry sort of thing. And then we sort of pushed some limits with some other things, just purely from a look perspective. I mean, we were all so, as you say, talking about taking inspiration, and you'd see a movie come out like Sony's Into the Spider-Verse and go, wow, never seen a feature, like an animated feature with a look like that before. How could we take some things from that and maybe scale them down or pull them back to do something for, you know, that might work for a TV pipeline? So we made some really fun things. And as a result, I think a couple of people stood up and took notice of us as, you know, this little shop that was, you know, had been known as a, you know, sort of almost the, a little bit the black sheep or the redheaded stepchild, as it were, of Wildbrain, and you know, that we had struck out on our own. And it was really gratifying. It was gratifying to do that. So that's, you know, and that was the collaborative nature and working with other people who you respect and admire, and making something together with that group of people, to me was also, you know, it was almost payment in and of itself to do that. But when you do something like that and then you know that it did, you also know that sooner or later, somebody else out there is going to go, yeah, that's really good. We'd like to, you know, like to find a way to show that to as many people as possible. So thankfully, you know, it's kind of what happened. We sold the Little Stompers as a series to Peacock, which is great. And they've been amazing. So that, yeah. But I mean, the core of that came from that place of going, why did any of us do this to begin with? We did this because we like making pictures and looking at them and it making ourselves smile and feel good about something that we made, as opposed to doing it for, you know, doing it because it's your job. We're still putting some energy behind some other smaller things, some smaller homegrown things that we really just want to do. And again, under that sort of notion of let's do something for ourselves first, right? Let's, you know, if we're going to do something, the best way for us to know whether or not we have something is to do it for ourselves first. And then if we are satisfied with it, then we know that we've got something that's going to be, you know, marketable.
Well, let's talk,
and worst case scenario, it's good for morale.
Yeah, morale is very important. Let's talk about the big talent-driven projects, like the Tom Hanks voices. How much of that weighs in when you go into production or a pitch? Do you care, or do you think first come up with the characters and then we'll make the right person? Do you drive the talent first, or do you drive the idea first, concepts?
Really, it very much depends. It really, really very much depends, right? Like if you are doing a show and the concept that you have is a preschool series or a book or something like that, and your target audience is 4, 5, 6 year olds, and then you go in to pitch that and you go, hey, I've got Tom Hanks to do the voice of the main character. There's not a single 4-year-old on this planet, including ones related to Tom Hanks, that give a damn whether or not he's involved. All that does is just up the price. You just now you're pitching somebody and saying, hey, this is not going to help the success of this, and it's going to mean it costs more, right? So, I mean, if you know that you're targeting 4-year-olds, what's the value that you're going to bring into 4-year-olds? Well, maybe you have, maybe your best friend or your cousin or your sister or your, you know, whoever is an incredible, you know, child psychologist or early childhood educational guru or somebody who somehow has something to offer to that audience. That's going to have the value, right? The star voice is going to do you nothing for getting an audience unless it's somebody that the audience cares about. So it's the real opportunity to make a difference. And to be overly political or anything, but when you look around at the world today, I always sort of go, you know what? I think people need more kids shows. Yep. Right? I think people need to get back to some basics, and we can't have enough shows teaching us how to be nice to each other, in my opinion. But having said that, you know, in terms of my daughter, yeah, she's a constant source of inspiration for me. She was when she was younger, and she still is now, even when I'm working on the things that are clearly not for her age demo. I'd love to be able to make things, more things. We do have a couple of, you know, we have a couple of properties that we're looking at. And again, getting back into the business of it, for years, it's been nearly impossible to sell any ideas for an audience older than 10, you know, even sell a show for kids. And it would be like, well, we're looking at like 8 to 12, you know, if it's animated, that really means 7 to 9 at best, right? Like once kids are sort of 10, you're really starting to lose them as an audience. But I feel that is, I mean, not just I feel it, it's inevitable. It's changing. It's absolutely changing with the proliferation now and popularity of things from Japan and Korea, the different layers of sophisticated storytelling. You have kids that grow up with animation, and then in their tweens they maintain, and then in their teens they maintain, and in their 20s they maintain, right? Like animation is just a different medium now for storytelling. So you're not losing that audience because of the medium anymore. And with that in mind, proportionally to the industry, in fact, I would say even a little bit over proportionally to the industry, we have also some properties in development that are aimed at an older audience. For sure, I take a ton of inspiration from my daughter in that regard, and, you know, try and listen as much as possible to things that matter to them, things that matter, things that they want to know, things that they need reinforcement on, things they need to hear. And so, yeah, as somebody who continues to make content for small children, what you're kind of hoping with a lot, I mean, there's a lot of stuff out there for small kids that's pure entertainment or mostly entertainment, or mostly distraction. You kind of hope that you get some good messages in there. And again, I'm a real huge fan of Fred Rogers and, you know, our Canadian Fred Rogers, who was Ernie Coombs, aka Mr. Dress Up, and, you know, and Sesame Street and the Muppets and these things. And you see these people who are making content for kids, genuinely trying to do something good, genuinely trying to use the medium to make a positive impact on these kids' lives. And so a little bit, you kind of want to see the people that they're becoming a little bit. You want to see what they're becoming as teenagers, or what they're becoming as young adults, what they're becoming as new adults. And so there's a little bit of opportunity there, both to listen to people of that age in terms of going back and making new content for younger kids, because you sort of go, oh, well, there was a positive message I was trying to get out when my daughter was 4, and now she's 14, 15. Did that stick? Did that work? So you want to sort of get that feedback, and then hopefully as well, you know, have opportunity to make content for those, you know, the people that were watching your shows when they were little, you like to sort of keep them as an audience as adults. You'd say, you know, if you still believe in it, if you still believe in, you know, if you still believe in these messages that we can all get along and that we can all do better together, then let's not forget about that. So, you know, it's kind of also the hope to continue. I'm at an age and a stage in my career now where there are people who watch stuff that I made and at the beginning of my career who now have kids that are watching stuff. So you kind of want to do right by all those people and sort of let folks know that you actually still do care and that these things that were important are still important as adults. So that was the thought I had on that.
Which is a perfect thought to go out on. It's a great message. Yeah, it's about humanity. It's about community, which was your word that you used earlier. And it's about legacy.
Yeah, trying to leave this place a better place than the way we found it, ideally, is kind of the goal.
And enjoying it while we're still here.
Yeah.
Philip, thank you so much for your time. I'm so glad we did this. And I'm so glad that all those aspiring artists will be able to listen to your story and learn from it and share. And like you say, it's a multi-generational business. So we have a multi-generational audience. And I really appreciate that everyone will learn a little bit about this industry from you. So thanks very much for listening to this episode, and please share all the episodes with your friends and colleagues. We appreciate your ratings and comments on Apple Podcasts and on social media. If you'd like more information about our programs and our special people and projects, please access www.morezap.com, More Zap Productions for Talent and Literary. And if you'd like to book a special one-on-one coaching or a group clinic or workshop, please access passion-power.com, and you can fill out our form there and make a request. Thanks again.